When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The expression from the music inspired me so much to take risks, and it inspired damn near the whole rap game.
Hello again, I'm Adam Unz. You may know me as the host of The Opus, and now I'm bringing my own show, The Spark Parade, to the Consequence Podcast Network. I speak with artists and creatives about the cultural artifacts that spark their personal interest and creativity, whether it's music, books, movies, video games, or any other kind of art.
I've never spoke about it in this amount of detail. I'm suddenly going, oh my God, I'm blowing my own mind here, Bryce. It's actually a giant part of my life.
By talking about the things we love, we share and discover insights into our personality and the things that drive us.
It's just magic, really. I mean, frustrating. And it makes some people angry, but I don't think anyone's ever done anything like it.
I speak with people like Connor Oberst, Phoenix's Thomas Mars, Chris Gethard, Helen Hong, Adrian Young, and more, so their sparks of inspiration can start a fire in you.
I'm grateful for those who continue to put our history and who we are as a people in the forefront and make you see it.
Find the Spark Parade wherever you get your podcasts.
V. Viana, the guitarist singer for indie punk group Gutless, has ska roots. She grew up in Brazil and learned about ska from her mom. She heard not only two-tone ska, but the music from several local groups like Paralomas do Sucesso. As a teenager, she lived in South Florida and found community and friendship at the talent farm and the local ska scene. It was the same scene that Jer, i.e. Ska 2 Network, came up in. And though she played ska back then, it's been a while. That is until earlier this year with the release of the Gutless ska single, Burning the Bridge, featuring Jer on all the horns. Today, V tells us her full story and how ska was a significant component that shaped her life.
Of all of our guests that I know from ska Twitter, I've actually met V.
Oh, really? When did you meet V?
Very briefly. It was at a fest last year.
Oh.
And I was winding my way through the crowd. And I noticed their two-tone hair, but I was like, hey, and they said, oh, hey. And that was our whole interaction.
Best friends forever.
Best friends forever now, though. That's what happens at Fest. You run into somebody and then you're best friends forever.
You combine that with being mutuals on ska Twitter and it's a solid bond. Nothing can break your relationship apart. You were telling me that the first time you ever hopped into a pit was at an Aquabats show?
Yeah, I was 14 years old, I believe. 14 or 15. It was like towards the end of my freshman year of high school. And like, I think I was in that stage, you know, of like being like a young punk, but still kind of figuring out what ska is as its own genre. But I was like, you know, around like message boards, punk news and stuff. And I got really into Fury of the Aquabats and Floating Eye. And when I saw they were coming by, it was the Culture Room in Fort Lauderdale. Yeah, I like just immediately jumped on that. And that was like my first like regional like punk type band like that I had seen live as well. I had gone to like a few local shows that like my older brother or his friends would play. But yeah, that was like my first time seeing like a touring band of that nature in the punk realm.
Do you remember what song you jumped in the pit during, or was it just there? They started playing and you jumped in the pit.
I think it was that. Yeah, I think it was that. And I know Victims of Circumstance, really cool Florida ska punk, opened that show. And that was like kind of the beginning of me really jumping into the Florida ska scene. You know, like before going to all the talent farm shows that I would start going to. Yeah, it's something real special about Florida and ska, honestly.
So what was your take on how you were to behave in the pit? Because I remember some of my early shows. I think some of my early shows that had active pits were Primus.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, I think, and it was a little aggressive, but, you know, I did my best to sort of evaluate the way people were and try to mimic it to some degree.
Gosh, yeah, I want to say that I did the same, but honestly, there's a good chance that I was very ignorant. I was definitely like starting to like skank and stuff, because like I think at that point I was like watching a lot of bands' live videos and like kind of got the gist of skanking. So it was a lot of doing that. I don't think I was like shouldering people or like throwing elbows or anything. But I think I did crowd surf. I will say I think I did crowd surf, and that's something that as an older person I'm way more anxious about than the safety of others.
Yeah, Culture Room has a remarkably high stage. Did you stage dive there?
I don't think I stage dived. I think I did the thing where I like made eyes with people and I'm like, hey, I'm a scrawny fucking 130 ounce, 130 pound like kid. Can you just lift me up? I want to feel something.
I don't think I've ever crowd surfed. Adam, have you ever crowd surfed?
Yeah, I weigh a lot more than 130 pounds. I currently clock in at 275. So me crowd surfing is always a bad idea.
I think my most memorable crowd surfing experience was like a fucking Andrew WK show, like nice. Also during high school. And it was one of those things where I have like a very cinematic memory of like a security guard eyeing me and being like, you're about to be out of here, kid. But then Andrew WK like tapped on his shoulder, like just went, no, 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 no. Like brought me up and like brought like 20 other people up, because that's just an Andrew WK show.
Yeah.
And like it was like after Never Let Down, I just like jumped and felt like I was soaring from the stage.
Now, we've talked about Andrew WK before on the show. Andrew WK doesn't play ska, but do they have ska energy?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, just in that sense of like dancing a lot and being very active in movement, but also the lookout for everybody type of energy.
Yeah.
I would say that I felt a lot of parallels with the ska shows I had been going to.
Yeah. Kind of aggressively positive too, Andrew WK.
Oh yeah. Which I was all about, you know, in high school. Cause I think, as I was getting into like punk and ska and stuff, really, I've always been around some punk music. Honestly, since the age of like 7, I was getting into like the Ramones due to like my uncles and stuff. But like in high school, I remember just kind of having this attitude where like it felt like the people that were into like indie or like 80s Britpop or like stuff like the Smiths like really looked down on me. Mm. So I kind of leaned into like the hyper-posy stuff pretty hard, where I was like, ew, whatever, at least I'm fucking having fun.
What is it that you liked about the Fury of the Aquabats so much?
Oh, like frantic energy and like, I was always really into horns. And I think that comes also from like Brazilian music, because I was born in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of that was like reminiscent, you know, like in, you know, the way the horns harmonize and like really fast, like ska and stuff. Cause I knew I was definitely into like fast music at that point. And yeah, it felt good to have something that like didn't take itself seriously as well, but like was still really tight musically.
So you grew up in Brazil. What age did you come over to Florida?
I was 10 years old.
10 years old.
Yeah. My family moved to Miami. I was born in Fortaleza, which is like on the northeastern coast. Like, so I feel like, yeah, like not a long flight from Miami, you know, because it's like northernmost point of Brazil to like southernmost point of the U.S. East Coast.
When you think about your childhood, what was like, what's the strongest mental image of that? Can you paint that picture for us?
It's a good question. Definitely like a lot of like, I don't know, I guess like trying different like identities or whatever, trying to keep up with other kids. Cause I think there was, I didn't see it as such back then, but kind of like a period of assimilation, you know, and we're like, oh, I really want to keep up with the cool American kids. I want to listen to what they listen to. I want to watch what they watch type stuff. And like, really struggling with the language. I think there was like 2 years where I really struggled to speak English and speak with folks. So that's something that like really stood out to me. Because in Brazil, like prior to that, it was just learning to play guitar and kind of being a really indoor kid, just with video games and Toonami or whatever.
What age did you start playing guitar at?
I started playing guitar right like 9 years old. Yeah. So like on my last year of like living in Brazil, my mom got me like a cheap like nylon string. And I started going to like an instructor that was just like down the street from my old Catholic school.
What was the first thing you learned how to play on the guitar?
So it's between Blitzkrieg Bop or Smoke in the Water.
Both great choices.
Yeah. I right away knew that I liked like chunky power chords.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, you learn that power chord and it's just off to the races. Like you're like, oh, I can move this anywhere on the E string and anywhere on the A string. All right, let's go.
Yeah. And like I said, like back in Brazil, I think I was like 7 years old. I was hearing Blitzkrieg Bop like everywhere because it was that weird point where it was like, it was on Tony Hawk. It was on the Jimmy Neutron soundtrack. And then I noticed that an uncle of mine had like an old like Ramones DVD of like interviews and like archived music videos. And yeah, that was like me really being like, oh yeah, punk rock's the thing and I'm all about this. And that led me to discovering like Rancid and like getting really into Green Day and everything else that was around at that time. And like eventually found my way to like Less Than Jake and like all of the Asia Man Records stuff.
Where in Brazil did you live?
I lived in Fortaleza most of the time, which is in the northeastern coast, but I also lived in Brasilia, the capital, which is like more south central, you know, closer to like São Paulo, Rio area. Yeah. And Fortaleza is an interesting place because it's, you know, the biggest metropolitan city in the northeast like area, but the northeast area is, you know, way more desolate as far as like public transportation and, you know, funding and stuff goes. You know, because it's not like the big world hub like those other cities are.
No, you told me that your mom introduced you to ska.
Yeah, my mom was really into the Specials and also into a lot of Brazilian artists that were blending ska. And this is something that I only started noticing like in recent years that I make an effort to reconnect with Brazilian music and Brazilian culture. A lot of bands from like the 80s, 90s, and even early 2000s were like playing a lot of ska, even bands that weren't strictly ska. But yeah, I think it started with the Specials. I have like a very vivid memory of being at the beach at like 8 years old or something like that, between 7 and 10 range. And there was like a stage set up on the beach and a little cover band, and they played A Message to You, Rudy. And I just immediately loved that song. And like my mom knew it. So like she like turned me on to all of that like after that.
Mm.
And that was still a few years from me like really clocking into what ska was as its own genre. But yeah, like that was really my first real like moment of infatuation with it.
I was doing some research on the Brazilian ska bands, and yeah, kind of to what you were saying, like I didn't really find, you know, from the older like 80s, 90s and stuff, too many like strictly ska bands, but definitely ska was something that a lot of bands played within their different kinds of genres and rhythms.
Yeah, it's super interesting. I feel like I, you know, very much see a parallel with like what was going on in the US too. Like during the big, you know, third wave boom, like a lot of bands just like started finding ways to incorporate it and blend it into what they were doing. And I have noticed that too in a lot of MPB or MPB, popular Brazilian music. There was a lot of, yeah, just folks like adding like fast upstrokes and horns of like the ska nature.
Does any bands come to your mind in terms of like older bands that played ska?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a big one for me lately has been Titans. That's the Portuguese word for Titans. If anyone wants to do a Google Translate to easily find it. yeah, Titans are great. And I think their first record was around 86. And there's a really good Portuguese translated cover of The Harder They Come by Jimmy Cliff.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, nice.
And they do it like super fun, too. There's like... the horn they gave it, they put horns in it that very much have like an 80s dance energy, which I really dug. And they've always done that too. Like even one of their much later albums, 2002, they did a record called A Melhor Banda de Todos os Tempos da Última Semana, the greatest band of all time from last week. kind of like a snarky, you know, satirical tune, almost to the energy of Sell Out by Real Big Fish. But it's like a really fun, like, ska song that I've even like started covering like on off. Like,
nice.
Yeah. And another one that I've been getting more into recently is Los Hermanos, which they kind of phased out the ska sound, but their first album is just straight up ska core, like beginning to end. And I think that's like mid-90s. Mm-hmm. It's wild. Like, I feel like it sounds like Keys Be Nights, like Catch 22, but it's like right around the same time. And yeah, just like weird, like intense, like hardcore beats and like weird synth stuff. Yeah, really dope shit. And one of the vocalists, Rodrigo, I'm fucking up his name. Rodrigo Amarante. He's still really active. He's doing like a lot of Baroque pop type stuff. I think his last record came out on Polyvinyl.
Oh wow!
Beautiful record called Drama.
But no more ska core.
No more ska core, which is always a shame to lose.
Yeah, yeah.
God, I remember discovering ska core specifically. That was like 15 years old, and it was. My friend Mia in high school, like, you know, because I was doing the more, like, getting into posse, lighthearted, like, pop-punky type ska. And Mia was always on, like, the hardcore end of things. And I think that was, like, my first window into, like, hardcore music. And she was like, hey, you like ska, right? Check out this band, Stuck Lucky. And I was immediately really hooked. And I started digging into Flaming Tsunamis and then the whole Community Records scene.
Nice.
And yeah, and then a few years after that, I just kind of discovered Abracadabra from all of like the tours and like connections they were making in the US, and I was like, oh shit, hell yeah, Brazilian band out here.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about them aside from, you know, just us bad time record consumers that are familiar with the new record and stuff?
Honestly, not really. And I would love to know more. I know I've caught them before. I believe they've done a tour with my friends in Wasabi, who also were in Community Records for a bit. And they were like a São Paulo, you know, kind of post-hardcore, but with horns type band. Mm-hmm. And yeah, no. So that band is actually like one that I could stand to like learn a lot more about. Because that was like... I'm already so far removed from like what was going on in Brazil and already it's still a few years away from catching back up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think they started in the mid 2000s, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they put out several or a handful of records before the most recent one.
Yeah. I think I started catching on to them around 2014, 2015 mm-hmm. when I like first moved to Gainesville. So I moved to Gainesville 2013, like right after I graduated high school.
What drew you to Gainesville?
Oh, you know, the typical stuff fest seemed like a good place to start like a punk band. It's funny because like I did the whole like, yeah, mom, dad, I'm definitely going to school there. I'm going to community college and spending most of my time playing in bands. yeah, I think Gainesville was really special to me too, because although like I love the camaraderie and community from places like the Talent Farm and all the other spots in like the Broward County area. I didn't live in Broward County. I was neighbors to Broward County in Dade County. And I loved driving to Broward County because it was a completely different energy. Like, kids there fucking showed up. They were super stoked to meet and see new bands. Miami-Dade County very much had more of this, you know, smoke cigarettes outside until my friends are on. Not to paint with a broad stroke, but that was certainly my experience. And so coming to Gainesville, I felt like there was way more of like that sense of community, but now in a place in which I actually reside and play in frequently.
I want to just go back a little bit to Brazil. I have to forgive me. When I see Brazilian words, my brain wants to pronounce it like Spanish words. So I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing these right.
You're good.
Os paramalos do sucesso.
Oh, os paramalos do sucesso. No, that's like my mom's favorite fucking band. I should have brought them up. Yeah.
I think they're like the first Brazilian band to play ska. And I think they even date back to the 70s. I don't know if they were playing ska back then, but in the 80s, it's my understanding that they were like the premier band to be playing ska in Brazil.
Absolutely. I think like they definitely have records, I think, like starting like in the late 70s, but their first record that really blew up, I think, was 82.
Mm-hmm.
That's like an arena band. That's a band that like forever can just pack like hundreds of thousands of people into a show to this day.
Wow.
I think they're still active. I think they're still active. Certainly a band that's like, you know, I don't know the whole story, but I know that's a band that has had to take a lot of hiatuses due to personal health issues and things. Always been super active from my understanding. And yeah, they very much had that kind of two-tone mixed with Brazilian pop style.
Yeah, definitely eclectic from what I was hearing. There was one, Oculus, I think
that's the
song I liked a lot.
Oh, I love that song.
Yeah, describe that song for people.
Oh gosh, it's a really cute song too, because the singer is like singing about how like he worries girls don't like him because he looks dorky with glasses. Because that's what óculos means. That's the Portuguese word for glasses. it's a really fun kind of like bouncy like poppy song.
Aaron and I both grew up in households with parents that weren't super keyed into like interesting music. What was it like having a mom that, like, I don't know, actually cared about music?
It was interesting because it was kind of contentious, because my dad definitely didn't.
didn't like music or didn't like her music?
He claims to not like music. I feel like a lot of that might have just been like stoic old dude stuff, like, oh, I don't want my kids to get into music because drugs exist or whatever. and I think he maybe felt like a little, I don't know, just anxious about the fact that I was getting into particularly punk rock at a very young age. No, but my mom, it was like constantly, like we always had like CDs of like her favorite like artists on the car. Also a lot of like old movie soundtracks, a lot of Dirty Dancing in Greece, like on my way to school.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think I very much got an early like passion for just listening to music, like listening for instruments and like orchestrations, like at a young age from just being that exposed. But yeah, there was that weird relationship a little bit, because like when I started playing shows at like 15 and stuff, my first few shows were at Churchill's Pub in Miami. Definitely a place that shouldn't be letting me in at 15, but they did most of the time.
Did you have a fake ID or?
Oh no, they did not care. Oh,
okay.
That's the thing, is every show would say 21 plus, but they would also just have bands of high schoolers there. so it was like really dumb joke. 21 plus in the streets, all ages in the sheets. God, that's a terrible joke. Anyways.
Yeah. When Adam and I grew up in, we grew up in this town called Gilroy in California, and there was no place to play, but there was a local band in high school called Dutch Courage, played kind of like a funk rap sort of thing. And they had talked to this local dive bar called Sandrino's. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, we're going to do a show. We're going to bring some people. It, complete dive bar, like seedy dive bar. And the band was all in, well, maybe they had like one member or two that were 21 plus, but it was all kids. And I went, there was no, you didn't even have to pretend to have a fake ID. It was just all kids at the seediest bar. And then there was a few more shows that happened there, but I don't think that lasted too long.
The best thing about Dutch Courage is that all their songs were like 7 minutes long. Because everybody got a solo and everybody had to rap like a good like 32 bars.
Yeah.
Oh, that's honestly beautiful. I love that. And that was kind of the same energy that Churchill's had. Like, you don't even need to worry about having a fake ID because like no one's going to check you, especially if you're like one of the high school kids that's always there, which was definitely a thing. But even now, 27 years old, been to a lot of dive bars since. I think that might be on the top five of the seediest. Also, rest in peace, because they unfortunately did not make it through the pandemic.
Yeah, I think Sandrino's is in my top five of seediest bars I've ever been to.
I literally just drove past where Sandrino's is or was. It burned down.
We buried the lead there.
Yeah. But it's now like sketchy, like month to month apartments and like a liquor store.
Oof, damn.
So like it's maintained the like gnarly vibe, but
yeah, the spirit hasn't left the site.
Definitely.
We'll be right back after this.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Do you know a band called, there's another Brazilian band, they started in the late 90s, called Movies Colonias de Acuja?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. That was another one that kind of appealed to me when I was doing my research.
Yeah, dang. Yeah, sorry, I'm slipping on those a little bit.
Do you know this, a newer band, Oleopardo? They're pretty active on online and Twitter and stuff.
Yeah. Oh, I did not realize they were on Twitter and stuff. Yeah, they came up recently because I was like catching up on a lot of things on Spotify, and I saw a Brazilian ska playlist, and their stuff came up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good band.
Really good band. Yeah, I'm like just now starting to listen to them. Like actually.
Yeah, I think they even do some like radio stuff down there too.
Oh, wonderful!
Like promoting ska.
Yeah. Do you recall seeing like what city like they're around?
No, I don't.
Gosh, yeah, it makes me wonder if they're like São Paulo area.
I know you were only a kid, but what was like the popular music of in Brazil happening kind of around, like you turn on the radio and this is kind of what was popular?
Well, I feel like it was always and I keep going back to this term, MPB. MPB, it literally stands for popular Brazilian music, which is, you know, that's very much just like the flavor of pop, like through the decades and stuff over there, like where it is like pop music as far as like chord structures and like the type of hooky melodies, but you know, with like influence of like samba rhythm and like instrumentation, like an influence from like bossa nova and things like that. Oh, but the thing is, the Northeast had a particularly controversial genre of music. I think it was like really looked down on from most of the country because it was seen as like a hick, like redneck thing. Called forró, which is forro with an accent, and that's just like extra like bouncy, lively, like accordion led music.
Okay.
Yeah, it was like super speedy and like super shouty with like a lot of accordion shredding, and like it was I was like kind of into it, again just for the sake of like pure energy, but I do remember there being like kind of a stigma, which honestly I can just say that for like the Northeast of Brazil as a whole, like people always talk about, like, yeah, us nordestinos, like, yeah, like, any kind of, you know, looking down on, like, oh, you're not as metropolitan, you're not as high class, yada, yada. It's very funny to think that, you know, it's kind of the inverse of a lot of the stereotypes people make in the U.S., where it's like people look down on the South like that versus the North.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of inverse that.
Yeah, it's always interesting to learn about how people within a country stereotype other parts of the country.
Yeah.
When I went to Oaxaca for my book back in 2019 to go to the Ska Festival, Scatlón, a lot of the bands were from Mexico City and stuff, and they were telling me that Oaxaca was looked down upon, and because there was more more darker skinned native people there, and so it was like because they were explaining to me racism in Mexico.
Yeah.
And that was their example.
Yeah.
It's like, and that was like a way to insult somebody was to call them Oaxacan. And it's so weird. It's so weird to hear how universal, like, racism is a tool for all people to use.
Oh yeah. It's basically, you can find it wherever imperialism has sunk its claws, sadly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, Latin America, definitely not exempt. You know, I've definitely noticed that in Brazil as well, like just different forms of like colorism, which it's particularly interesting in Brazil because like, I feel like, I don't want to mess up any statistics, but I feel like it's close. It's like over like 40%, like nearing 50% of like folks are like, you know, like some form of like being mixed race.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's certainly not something that I comprehend to like the extent of a person that like regularly lives there. But yeah, there's different definitions for like different types of ethnicities and like different forms of discrimination that are very much, yeah, like come down to like, yeah, like skin tone of varying shades.
I this was a long time ago, but I remember hearing about that, about Brazil, and my wife was telling me that, because it was a study about how this idea that race, the idea of race, is a construct.
Mm-hmm.
Because every, you know, like Brazil was an example that,
yeah,
there was these different races that would not the way that we think about race in the U.S. And of course, our ideas about race have changed over time as well, you know.
Yeah.
A good example being that Italian at one point was not considered white, but now is considered white.
Right.
I had heard that some of the concepts about race were very different in Brazil.
Certainly. Yeah. It's like, yeah, it feels like there's different forms of, you know, categorization as far as like the systemic racism goes there.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, no, that's honestly a very interesting point and something that I think about a lot, not just the way that, you know, racism is clearly a social construct, but a social construct that takes different forms in different societies.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and no, very much like a thing that I felt like, yeah, like from childhood, just like noticing the ways people around me talk about other people, and like, yeah, it was something that I think I started perceiving like pretty early, like definitely before like moving to the U.S.
So you moved to the U.S. and now you're an immigrant. Is that something that,
yeah,
you had to deal with much, or did you have ways to sort of manage that?
Yeah, I think that there's been, I've definitely had ways of managing that. It took different forms, you know, because there's everything from, you know, kids like picking on me for having an accent or like not like grasping the language as quick as others might. But then there were other more like internal forms of assimilation, you know, to go back to the whole, you know, you're like 10 years old and you're about to become a teen. The sad reality is you do want to be cool and you do like, yeah, want to feel like you have peers and shit around you. So like that was like a point where I started to say like, all this Brazilian shit that like my mom listens to is lame. Like, yeah, like, I'm going to listen to fucking AC/DC or whatever. No, but yeah, no. So that's the thing is I think I felt all kinds of different struggles, like as an immigrant, some internal, some external, certainly. And that's something that I kind of started writing about a lot in my music with Gutless. You know, the new record that we're like seeking to release this summer after a lot of delays has a song called Homeland Insecurity, which has both Portuguese and English vocals. And it's essentially a song about how like the migration process has sometimes left me like not knowing what my true home or my true homeland or whatever really is. Like, I feel like I do still kind of contend with feelings of, I don't know, isolation from both general cultures. And I also like the election of Bolsonaro, like kind of like hit me like in a certain way, you know. I grew up, you know, in a Catholic school, so I was already like struggling with unprocessed feelings of queerness and gender dysphoria. And Bolsonaro was elected like when I was like kind of shortly out of the closet as a trans woman, and it messed me up. I was like, oh damn, this feels like a rhetorical abandonment of folks like me, you know. And I also kind of simultaneously felt this shame of like having stayed distant from the culture for so long. And yeah. And so that's kind of what that song Homeland Insecurity ended up being about, you know, where it's like, oh yeah, I left behind the first like home country I've had to end up in a place that feels very bigoted and spiteful towards me. Only to see the place that I came from also be bigoted and spiteful towards me.
I know that he's been pretty bad. Is he a downgrade, or is it kind of what it's always been like there for political leaders?
That's the thing. The thing about Bolsonaro is he's definitely not equivalent. I feel like people make too many equivalencies between this, but there's definitely a similar energy to like Trumpism, you know, where there's like, yes, there's been like right wing, like Christian based, like, you know, fascist light presidents before, but like, he kind of just comes in with like this very brazen energy. Like he's like, he doesn't really dog whistle as much. And I often go back and forth on whether that's a good thing or not. Like he's been on television, like encouraging parents to like hit their kids if they quote show signs of gayness, you know? Wow. Yeah. And has very much like kind of fed into like a lot of like racial, like white supremacist rhetoric as well. And I mean, I think that's another thing that's important to note about Brazil is that despite there being like such a large population of various communities of color and various different like ethnicities, it is primarily like a white government and like a government of white like leaders.
That's interesting. That's something you wouldn't really imagine like thinking about Brazil.
Yeah, it's you really wouldn't, but it's been such a fact of like its infrastructure for so long, and it is sad to think about. But I feel like it's also one of the first signs that, yeah, things were never really, from my examinations, never really politically, like, you know, in the side of the oppressed. But yeah, with Bolsonaro, there very much was just kind of like, yeah, this energy of, we can hide like our bigotry, like way less now, you know, like a lot of those things started becoming like less shameful to say in mass.
I have often wondered that in the past. Is it better to have the racists be hide their racism, or be, you know, let you know that they're racist? But I think the Trump era has showed me that it's better if they're not brazen about it, because I think for one thing, it encourages other people who maybe aren't maybe bad people, but maybe have some influences in their life, it kind of encourages them to go down that path. And I also think that when they're more brazen, they're more likely to actually act out violence against communities that, you know, that are oppressed or disenfranchised. And that's just not good. It's, I mean, yes, it sucks to like be questioning people, like, are they racist or not racist, but it's still better to not feel like afraid that they're going to actually act out in violence.
Yeah. You actually, you make a really good point that, that there is like a validation of the rhetoric. I definitely see that. And I think that's what I felt with Bolsonaro. Cause like, I've definitely, and that's another thing is like, it does surprise me that like Brazil has like had such early strides in like, you know, like marriage equality and things of that nature, because I don't know, maybe this was just my experience as a closeted kid. It always felt like overwhelmingly homophobic to me and overwhelmingly like bigoted as a whole. But again, my experience, my region of the country and, you know, my surroundings and schooling. So it kind of felt like, it just went a more mask off route. And it did kind of, I don't know, exacerbate all those prior anxieties I had, you know.
So now you moved to Florida. We started the show. You talked about that Aquabats show. You said that it was your first sort of like bigger band, but you'd seen a few local shows.
Yeah.
What was your introduction to local music and like the idea of there being bands and a scene or whatever?
Yeah, my introduction was my older brother Lucas. He was playing in a crossover thrash band called Acidosis. That band fucking rips. I still like go back to their old recordings sometimes, like particularly like their first single Tied to the Tracks. That shit rules. It was led by my friend Ben Katzman, who still like does like a lot of music under Ben Katzman's The Greaser is his current project. And I love Ben because he's always had like this energy of like really wanting to deliver just like power pop, but with like intense like shredding and like thrash influence. And my brother was starting to play Churchill's Pub, so like Churchill's Pub was like the first my first conception of a DIY space. And like I definitely took for granted the fact that they had been around since the fucking 70s. Like I think that place has been a venue since like 1975 up until like recently, and that's definitely nuts to think about. But yeah, that was like the first venue I knew of. And like back to like the thing with my parents, there was like a sense of contention, you know, because I started playing my shows there at 14 and 15. My first show ever was there. And, you know, my dad would like kind of like try to shame me out of it, or I don't know, maybe not shame me out of it, but like just express a lot of discontentment. And I feel like my mom wanted to be more supportive, but kind of like felt this pressure of like, you shouldn't be letting your kid do this, like type thing, like, which I sympathize with a lot of it, you know, because I was a 14, 15 year old kid, like, you know, kind of regularly hanging out in a rough part of Miami until 2 a.m. on school nights. But after Churchill's Pub, there was also Sweat Records, or still is, I think, which is a record shop, like, literally neighbors to Churchill's Pub, I think even like connected like the same building. And they actually put on all ages shows that were like all ages on the flyer. But yeah, literally next door, same area. So those are like my primary spots for booking when I was in Dade County. And then I started learning of the Talent Farm like maybe a year after, and you know, and this is how I met like folks like Jer and stuff, and saw like their first bands and a lot of like the pop punk, ska, and hardcore bands that were being formed. And like, yeah, it kind of had this energy of like, oh, in Dade County we were playing with like, you know, random adults who kind of had their own things going on and didn't give a shit about what we were doing with my early bands. And then with the Talent Farm, it's just like, oh yeah, no, everyone here is a weirdo the same age as me, and we're all hyped on this.
So tell people about, so the first time you saw Jer, they were in...
They're in Funkman's Inferno.
All right.
Yeah. I don't know how much they've told you about Funkman's Inferno, but that band was a goddamn trip, and I always loved seeing them.
Well, let's hear. I have not heard much.
Yeah, tell us about Funkman's Inferno.
So, I want to clear something up real quick. They were not a funk band. They had one funk song. Agree?
Do you remember the name of the one funk song?
I think it was Take Me Back to Yesterday. Nice. Gosh, I wonder if Jared's going to be upset about this. No, but, yeah. So, and they did do like one album that I think I still have it on like a little like plastic sleeve, like here somewhere. But they were like a 13-piece band most of the time. I've seen them have even more members. They had a fucking flute player. They had a tuba player. Like, it was so beautiful because it was just like, oh yeah, these are clearly all kids from like the same high school band class just doing like a ska band together with instruments that are unconventional even for ska.
Did Jer play trombone?
Jer played bass in that band.
Oh, yeah. I've seen pictures. I have seen pictures.
Yeah. And that was back when we were doing, like, the themed shows, too. Like, we did, like, the Rocky Horror Ska Show. And, gosh.
What was the Rocky Horror Ska Show like? Give us, paint a picture.
There were occasional Rocky Horror covers, but it was mostly just a ska show where people kind of, you know, dressed, like, a little goth or like a little draggy, which thinking back on it, that's actually very rad. Cause so many of us were just like young kids that like, I don't know, maybe wanted to like, try out or flirt with queerness, but we're like, you know, like too closeted to think that. I think Jer and I had, and our friend Sadie, like said something along the lines of like, wow, it's kind of nuts to think how many kids from that talent farm scene have come out of the closet in the past few years.
Were you aware of any local ska bands or punk bands before Talent Farm, or was that your introduction to the local scene?
It kind of was, because I definitely like knew like punk bands like in Dade County, but to be honest, they're kind of hard to remember again, because many of them just, I don't know, I guess didn't really bother like making like a connection besides like sharing a bill. There was also a band from my high school, The Alternate Stage. That was I actually briefly did lead vocals for that band, and that was pretty fun. It was kind of like that easy core pop punk with breakdowns type stuff, but with ska. Like ska parts and horns, and my favorite thing was doing like a ska cover of Kids by MGMT.
Yeah, that sounds like a good song to turn into ska.
Yeah. And I was playing in a band called Sluggage, which was like, you know, punk with ska parts, that type of band.
It was called Sluggage?
It was called Sluggage.
How'd you come up with that name?
Oh God, it was... I think I was just like looking at like, I was really into The Descendants and like looking at all the songs like My Kids or whatever that they end with H-E-E. Mm. And I was like, oh, put that on Slug. Not that much thought beyond that.
So no sludging metal or anything?
Oh no, just straight up pop punk with the occasional ska parts.
Yeah, I would have come at that completely different. I would have thought it was like Slow Luggage. Slow Luggage.
I'll save that one. I'll save the God. I could name a record that and just be like, if you know, you know.
Yeah.
No, but yeah. And for the most part, I think it was just like, yeah, like us, The Alternate State, and the occasional like bands from our high school that would like be on and off. And then like, yeah, with Talent Farm, I knew like Funkman's Inferno. There was a great band called Great Scotch, which like, kind of had like the streetlight energy, you know, of like trying to tell big stories with a kind of like, I don't know, I guess cinematic type of energy. Gosh, there was like a lot. I'm like blanking right now, but Talent Farm was just sweet because like, and many people call that their second home and stuff, because it was just, yeah, it was like my first time being in like a venue that actually felt like a community of people who like regularly show up and like want to be friends with everybody and want to get like every band's information to link up later.
Can you recall your favorite Talent Farm show?
Oof, my favorite Talent Farm show. Gosh, that's hard. I do think back to, and I know Jer has talked about this because I listened to the episode they did with you recently, the No Damage show, which was the show where everyone covered Damage, like besides like two bands, including my shitty band.
you were in one of the bands.
I was at Sluggish, played that show, I'm pretty sure.
Okay, so let's get a little deeper into this. So before the show, was that part of your set? Was that something you planned specifically for this show?
I think people were, my memory of it is I think people were murmuring about it and giggling about it because it had already been a thing that song was very frequently covered by locals. Okay. And I think we all just knew the song. So we're like, hey, like if people are doing this bit, we can easily get in on it type thing.
But were you surprised that all of the bands but one or two played it?
Honestly, I don't even think I was. I don't even think I was, because just covering that song had already become kind of a staple. it almost like was already its own like haha thing. But that was like the first time that I saw like six or seven sets with different renditions of Damage by Blink-182. So that one is special for that reason. gosh, but one that stands out to me a lot, and like I saw like Joyce Manor and Hopalong play there like 2012, 2013, like towards my senior year of high school. Nice. Yeah, that was a fantastic show. I think like Of All Things was like a really recent record. Get Disowned was like also, I think, like just released. Yes, and that was also like, you know, it's funny when I think back to my high school years, like the first half, definitely more like posy ska, like frantic pop punk. And then the second half was when I started just getting really into emo and indie, which is funny because I feel like I used to have like such, I don't know, I used to have like a bit of snide like towards that. And it was very much just like silly and associated with like, again, like artsy Miami kids who would like look down on ska and like pop punk. But yeah, because like I got really into Jawbreaker like junior year, and like Bomb the Music Industry was like my favorite band towards the end of high school. And you know, I think that was kind of just the big Venn diagram. They were like the band that did like everything like in my eyes.
Yeah,
that's eventually like kind of like what led to Gutless, you know, those influences, because Gutless started 2015 2016. I was playing solo with the name 2015, and it kind of became a band 2016. So for a while I was like kind of leaning into just like the Jawbreaker type sound, you know, like sometimes being fast but other times just being like, you know, a little droney and arpeggiated and like still like loud and screaming. And it feels real good to have released the ska song with that project this year. The first single that we did of this album, Burning the Bridge, it's funny because it wasn't a ska song. It was not a ska, like I first demoed it with like that first verse with the ska part just being palm muted, and it was when we got him at my drummer Timmy's garage that I don't know. I guess it didn't feel like it was hitting it for me. So as a joke, I started doing like upstrokes in the verse, and I was like, oh wait, no, this is actually way better. And this was like after years of me like also trying to write ska songs, but kind of feeling like, you know, so something about the ska songs I was trying to like write for a while just felt like, I don't know, like too basic in my eyes. I had this feeling of like, I respect the genre too much to do a half-assed job with it. Yeah, so it felt good that one just kind of like landed that way. And I also kind of had it in my mind, you know, that like with that song, I particularly really wanted to just challenge that notion of ska being necessarily fun, happy, and goofy. Because And I guess this, I should probably throw a content warning for this section, because that song is primarily about like sexual assault and like, you know, being kind of like made to feel small by people you consider your friends, like for the sake of like hazing and like, you know, putting others down. So I was like, yeah, I guess I think I really want to fuck with people's expectations of ska and like deliver all of that in our, in the ska song.
Yeah. I mean, people have this preconceived notion that ska is silly music, but it's not.
It's not, especially when you look at its history, like, and like its political history. Yeah. So that, and I was also like kind of thinking about, you know, like bands like The Clash, who like, you know, weren't a ska band, but had like really good ska songs that were very much like explorations of serious topics. And I think I was really inspired by that.
How has the song been received?
Honestly, it's really, really good. I think a lot, definitely one of the best receptions I think this band has ever gotten. Having Jer played on it helped a lot. And I'm super grateful for how hard they went too. Because, yeah, this record has been in production for a very long time. It's kind of been consuming me since 2019. When we first started tracking in the studio, but then got too busy with shows, then the pandemic hit, then, you know, kind of were unable to get back to the studio. So I started just seeking to get all the stems in a hard drive to like finish it at home. And then it was like at this point, like 2 years after I had gone to Jer's house to like write horn parts, that I hit them up and I was like, hey, Jer, by the way, the album is still happening. It's not canceled. Do you still want to do those horn parts that like we bounced around a while ago? And they were down. And to my surprise, like a week later, they sent me like 7 different WAV files of horns. I think even more if I count like doubles, because it was like a trumpet, a tenor sax, 2 different trombone tracks like harmonizing, and actually I think 2 different sax parts harmonizing. And then I told them that this part of the song is very chaotic and I want it to sound like a panic attack, so feel free to just record some noise. They sent me like just 4 or 5 different tracks of just trombone slides going and that was like really fun to like mix in there. Yeah, so knocked it out of the fucking park and did way more than I requested or expected.
The video for the song, there's footage of your band with Jer playing trombone. What was that? Was that an actual show or was that like just a video shoot?
Oh yeah, that was an actual show. It's because it's very hard to get our band together outside of actual shows. But that was the fest. That was the last fest that happened. Yeah, last year.
Oh, okay.
Like right before I moved to New York too. Yeah, Jer was around, and at that point, like the album version had been fully tracked, so like they knew the part, and they're like, we bumped into each other like the day before, and I was like, "Hey, Jer, want to do Burning the Bridge?" And they're like, "Yeah." And a friend of mine just thankfully like recorded it, and I literally just took the footage of their phone and inserted it in there.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
So before this, you made a record called Some Voids.
Yeah, that's right. That was 2017. It's still a very special and dear record to me.
Yeah, do you want to talk a little bit about the record and what's kind of behind it? It seems like, you know, there's a lot of personal journey elements of the record.
Yeah, certainly. Because, yeah, and the thing with Gutless in general is I kind of started it as like this project of, you know, practicing vulnerability in music. Because, yeah, a lot of the music I was writing in high school, a lot of it was, you know, good time music, for the lack of a better explanation. And the closing track of Some Voids, The Breaker, was something that I wrote even way before that album or that EP. And I knew I wanted to reserve it for something like really solid. I considered that the first good song I ever wrote. But yeah, it's very much me kind of just being honest about feelings of depression and anxiety from the beginning. And even the song Growing Apart is a song about, you know, me really seeking to find the words to describe dysphoria. Because it's a song essentially about wanting to come out of the closet, but having this fear that it's going to shake up like all of my friend groups, my family, and just like all, this all-consuming anxiety around it. And just this idea of like, oh yeah, like this feeling that some shit is just never going to get resolved, like this kind of doom and gloom mode, like surrounding the idea of coming out of the closet, which thankfully has not been the case. But yeah, it's Some Voice is very special to me because it is a record like of like my perspective as I'm in like the cusp of really actualizing a lot of things about my identity and about like my struggles.
So you wrote it when you were there at that place in your life. Where were you at when you released it? Were you still kind of in that same place, or had you already gone through some of these things like coming out?
Yeah, I was 1 foot in, 1 foot out. That's how I describe it. Because that record came out March 2017, and I came out October 2017. No, so that was like the thing. And I think the thing is too, at that point, I was living a little bit of a double life, you know, between like the punk scene in Gainesville and like my family in Miami, you know, where in Miami, I did what a lot of us gals refer to as boy moding. you know, just really kind of like repressed like the entire life that I was living in Gainesville, which was I was starting to find comfort with feminine clothing and like makeup and like different forms of expression and, you know, being more openly queer with the friends that I trusted around me there. It was getting to a point where I was compartmentalizing that really, really hard and starting to get the, oh, are you gay questions? You can just tell me, like, I'm not going to think anything about it. You know, like those kind of questions that people don't realize are placing a lot of pressure on you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I kind of spent like a good few months, like, yeah, after the release of that record, just figuring out, you know, how to go about like coming out and stuff. Cause it's like, I was starting to realize that like, this is real and I need to, it was definitely a bit of a tightrope walk for a while, you know? And a lot of that was, you know, me just kind of feeling my anxiety around it fester and like having a lot of presumptions about how people, particularly family, would react. And it was mostly positive. You know, my mom has been a fucking superhero since day one. She's been awesome. Like she works as an esthetician and works in, like she does waxing and laser hair removal. And I remember the first time I said, Mom, I'm trans. One of her quickest responses was, it's okay. You want to go to the clinic? I was like, oh, right on. Gosh. That's a privilege not many have. And I have to count myself grateful for that.
Being on the other side of that announcement, do you feel like not having all of those presumptions and worries like hanging over your head? Like, how does that feel?
Oh yeah, it's almost hard to like compare like my life now and then, you know, because I was so consumed by those presumptions, you know. It definitely feels like it's easier to just trust people now. I think that's the main thing is. I still struggle with anxiety a lot, but I walk with a lot less distrust of those around me, you know? Like, obviously, I can't speak for, like, every rando in the street, but it's like I no longer feel like this need of distrusting, like, my family and, like, my friends. Like, so that's, like, really huge. And, like, also just having found, like, you know, queer and trans musicians and, like, just, yeah, finding folks that, like, not only make me feel seen, but, like, empowered. Like, that's been huge for me. And definitely something that I feel took a good few years, you know? I feel like I didn't really start, having a sense of community related to that specifically, like, until really, like, two years into my transition, which has been about five now.
With Gutless, you have some songs where you sing in Portuguese. Is there, when you do sing in Portuguese, is there usually a reason, or is it just like you have these, it's almost like you have these tools of which to use, and sometimes this tool makes more sense than the English one?
You know, lately it's been more of the latter, but when it started, it actually was more of the first, because I did all of Some Voids in Portuguese. I have, you know, Alguns Vazios is the Portuguese version of that record, and it's the same instrumentals. I just recorded new vocals, and funny enough, that idea actually first came from Vinny Fiorello of Less Than Jake. Because I was working at the, years ago, I was like 19, 20, like in college, and like I was an intern at like the paper and plastic warehouse. And, you know, yeah, very much just still kind of like a starry eyed teen onto young adult that was like, whenever he was around, I'd be like, hey, Vinny, do you want to listen to like this thing that I just tracked? So he heard some very early versions of Some Voids and like kind of planted that idea. It was like, you speak Portuguese, right? Like, you know, that's like a whole audience that you're potentially like not reaching, like if you don't make use of that. And it took me a while to really act on it, but like that idea kind of stuck with me for a long time. Because I did the Portuguese version, I released the Portuguese version like 2019, January of 2019. I actually just kind of dropped it on the day of Bolsonaro's inauguration, you know, as like a form of, I feel like queer and trans Brazilian voices are about to be hella shut down right now. So here's me. just putting that out there, you know, like here's a record that's explicitly about closeted trans pain, now sung in Portuguese. Yeah. So when it started, it was just the idea of like, oh yeah, no, I want to see if doing this entire record in Portuguese, like, will maybe find new ears, will maybe find like, you know, resonance, with folks of a similar struggle. But yeah, but now if there are songs in our upcoming album Build and Burn that have Portuguese lyrics, often like thrown in with songs with English lyrics, and yeah, to me those have like a lot more intent, you know. Like in Homeland Insecurity, that's a song about like feeling disconnected from your first home and your current home, so there's the back and forth made sense to me in that context. The song, and this was released as the second single, Byakugan Princess, that ends with a shouted Portuguese a verse of Meu corpo não seu, my body not yours. And that's a song specifically about like, you know, pushing back against, you know, dudes who are just fetishists over like specific portions of your identity. So that it felt very reclamational in that sense to just have like that shouting section.
I see.
So little column A, little column B.
Now I'm curious, we are now in an era where a ska Twitter is a thing.
Yeah, it's honestly pretty phenomenal to witness. I love it.
Have you felt like part of the modern ska scene, you know, for a while, or more recently kind of feeling part of it via Twitter? I'm curious your take on the current scene, the bands you're interested in, and then your more recent connection to it.
Yeah. I definitely think that, like, I've never stopped listening to ska, but I think this current, wave of ska Twitter, or like, you know, a Ska internet community. I feel like that's really reinvigorated the sense of community around the genre, you know, something that I felt was kind of missing in my life since like the Talent Farm days, where it's like, yeah, people just like uplifting new bands for the sake of like, not only digging them, but also like forming a community around them. And it's funny because, again, you know, I'm not in a strictly ska band, but I have just like so much love for it and love like, you know, nerding out about it, that it does feel really sweet to just have like friends made from the internet out of doing that. And mm-hmm. A lot of really incredible music has been discovered through that. Like I, you know, love Cat Bite. I adore Tape Girl. Tape Girl, I like Jer put me onto her, and it hit that bomb the music industry spot for me, as well as, you know, love hearing another trans voice in ska. And I adore K-Moy. I listen to the Precure album so much, and I've become friends with Kenny since, and like, you know, Kenny's out here in New York as well, and like have jammed before. Phenomenal human being and phenomenal musician. Sometimes I'm in fucking awe at how good Kenny is, because we were jamming one time and Kenny's just like, oh yeah, so like this chord is like kind of like a D13, but not really. Anyways, here's how you do it. And I'm just like, obviously, I've always enjoyed We Are the Union. I've always liked We Are the Union since I was in high school. But like this new era of them, like it's really like, I think reinvigorated my love for that band a lot, just seeing like the different ways that mm-hmm. they've progressed and evolved their sound. And, you know, obviously the topics that Reed has become started exploring and really resonating with me. Ordinary Life is definitely one of my favorite records of recent years. Really fucking, yeah, just with the entire Bad Time record scene. And like Kill Lincoln, I saw like, I used to see like even back at Fest, like 2013, 2014. I love that they're still holding that down. That band's fantastic. And I saw them with Eichlers a couple months back here in New York at Transpicos. And that was like my first like just pure ska show in like a long time.
Yeah, what was that like?
Oh, wonderful. I think I still kind of had some, you know, COVID world show anxieties.
Sure, yeah.
a lot of I haven't done this in a long time. How do my arms and legs work? Type feelings of like, does everyone else feel as weird as I do right now? But no, it was super lovely. Yeah, like people were dancing. It was a mostly masked event, from what I recall. and Best of the Worst also played that, and they were fantastic. Sorry, I just wanted to throw that in.
No, I remember Adam and I both saw We Are the Union, Eichlers, and Half Past Two.
Also a great band.
Yeah, and I've been a fan of these bands, and I've been part of the community of these bands for a while. But to me, in terms of a live event, that seemed like my first real experience of seeing a ska show that felt like, this is not the old generation ska scene. This is the new generation ska scene. Mm-hmm. Like it felt super clear, and it felt like the bands were embracing it and the audience was embracing it.
Yeah.
It was really cool. I was very happy to see it because, you know, you have to have a new generation to keep it vibrant.
Totally. And yeah, I felt that too, you know, it very much feels like, you know, I think people have maybe put too much importance into the idea of a fucking fourth wave or whatever, but like, it very much is like a new chapter in like, yeah, in the genre's presence in our culture. And yeah, there's characteristics that are just super unique to this current wave of ska, which I love. It makes me super excited. And you're right, it is always important to like see like new generations like kind of give the genre its own identity and its own meaning to them.
Yeah.
And yeah, and like I think about things like that. I think about like Eichler's doing like hyper ska and like really like all the different like new sounds that has like come out of just that idea and like their wonderful record. I think about like, you know, Bothered Unbothered, fucking phenomenal album. And like Jared had been sharing demos with me of that one for like a few years, so I just been kind of like antsy waiting for it to like be released. So yeah, it made me really happy to see it blow up the way it did. But like, yeah, just the way that it has like, you know, hip-hop influence and like indie emo influence, like I love seeing that, you know, because to go back to like what I said earlier, I feel like ska is just blends so well with other genres, you know. There's something really, I think, unique about the versatility of ska and like how well it can be worked into other styles of music.
Thank you so much for listening to In Defense of Ska. If you've enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe to the podcast wherever you normally stream or download episodes. If you haven't already, grab a copy of my book, In Defense of Ska, available at clashbooks.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. It's at In Defense of Ska. And please consider joining our Patreon at patreon.com/indefenseofska. You will get monthly bonus episodes, extended interviews and commentary per episode, and access to the In Defense of Ska Discord. In Defense of Ska would not be possible without the great team that tirelessly works on it every week. So you should go check out their other projects as well. Co-host Adam Davis has an amazing band called Omnigon. Give them a follow on Instagram and Twitter. It's simply at Omnigon. And our editor, Chris Reeves, has a phenomenal record label and podcast called Ska Punk International. For more information, go to skapunkinternational.com. And if you've ever enjoyed one of the highly specific In Defense of Ska memes floating around the interwebs, it was likely the work of The Bands I Like Only Charge $18. Find them on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And on that note, we leave you by saying, ska now more than ever.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.